society's ideas of morality and bring to surface some tender topics. For more details, head to the Grey Areas Facebook page. Tune in from 9 a.m. till 12 p.m. on June 15. You won't regret it.
Rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? And I've only done like
1%. And bang, it was in like a split second. I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge, to SCR's
Alrighty, good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge for the Thursday the 15th of June. I'm Jesse Begley and this is Razor's Edge, Sydney's own New South Wales-focused current affairs program. This week we have four stories covering the most relevant and upcoming news made for the local audiences of Sydney. From Bondi to Blacktown, Hornsby to Sutherland, our producers are out and about covering stories from your local area. This week we chat with the National MP Trevor Khan on the debate of euthanasia in Australia. We take a close look at the co-working spaces with the Chief Space Officer Tashi Dorji, and we discuss the rising prison rates in New South Wales and Australia with Professor of Criminology Eileen Baldry. You're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. First up, let's go to the debate on euthanasia. We speak tonight on our first piece of three with 2SER's round table discussion. From the pro-life argument versus the assisted dying perspective, there have been many overwhelming public discourse for and against euthanasia, with an increase of support for the terminally ill and the elderly. Today, producer Monica Samayoa chats with the National MP Trevor Khan to give us the lowdown on the public support for doctor-assisted euthanasia. Is it a human rights issue or is it an ethical concern? You decide. Presenting the case for the state of New South Wales to align with their overseas counterparts, Canada, Belgium, Germany, Italy and Switzerland.
In May, a new voluntary assisted dying bill was drafted between five parties: Nationals, Liberal, Independent, Labour and Greens. This bill allows those who are terminally ill and over 25 to request and receive assistance in ending their lives. There have been several bills that have been presented but have failed to pass in Parliament. Now, these five parties have worked together to create a new bill and hopefully pass it in Senate in August. In a series of talks, I first speak with MP Trevor Khan, who explains in detail the bill, the safeguards for doctors, and the growing public support. What are the requirements for this bill in order for those who are terminally ill to request and receive assistance in ending their lives?
What it requires is two doctors, a primary medical practitioner who is likely to be a general practitioner, and then a specialist in the field in which the person is suffering the illness. Once those doctors have determined that the patient essentially has been provided with the information with regards to their illness, the alternatives of treatment, and there is an assessment that the person is not going to survive for more than 12 months, then the further requirement is either a psychologist or psychiatrist must assess the patient as to their mental capacity and also as that the decision is voluntary. That is, they've come to the decision on their own basis. They're not being convinced to do it by a relative, for instance. It's essentially, in that sense, a three-step test. There is the added element that a close family relative is entitled to seek a judicial review of the decision that their relative has made. And again, that's to ensure that there is satisfaction on the part of the family that this is a voluntary and informed decision-making process. Primary focus is on giving people the alternative in the end stage of their life to reduce their discomfort and disability by terminating their own life.
What are the current laws?
A person is entitled now to refuse treatment, and there is nothing a doctor can do about that. So, for instance, there's some very clear law on the question that a patient is entitled to refuse sustenance, food and water, and terminate their life that way. The doctor is not entitled to force that on a patient, but what we're doing here in a bill such as this is inviting the members of the medical profession to take a more active role, both in the assessment of the patient and also the provision of the drug, which would assist in terminating a person's life. It is, for some members of the medical profession, a serious step. Some will not want to be involved to that extent.
What are the safeguards and the protections provided for doctors?
The protection that's provided to doctors here is to ensure that they can, for instance, refuse to participate at all in the process. There will be some medical practitioners who simply are not comfortable with the process, even with the safeguards that are involved, and therefore they cannot be forced to participate in the scheme. What it was designed, essentially, was to protect those with a conscientious objection against such a scheme as this. For instance, in the most extremist of cases, a patient were unconscious. It is not possible under this legislation for somebody else to substitute themselves in and make the decision for the patient. If in the case of the unconscious patient, this bill would say that not possible for anyone to intervene to terminate that person's life. And we're quite clear on this. And again, this is what differentiates this style of bill from, for instance, some of the European legislation. This is a bill that requires input in each of the stages by the patient.
What about those people that are under 25?
Well, look, the reality of this bill is it defines a class, and the class that it seeks to define is that class of people who are most likely to fall within the who are most needy in terms of such a bill, and that's generally older people who are experiencing the general diseases that we suffer with increasing age, and generally cancer-related diseases, but there are a number of others. You could identify a whole range of other people apart from young people who are not assisted by a bill such as this. And the Victorian experience, where they're looking at the issue, for instance, there are demands from groups who support dementia sufferers. Groups such as that should be considered in Victorian legislation. Now, we took a view that the use of legislation like this should be strictly controlled and directed to the most needy of groups, and that's why we defined it in the way that we have, that is, to the terminally ill over 25 who've gone through these hurdles of the two medical practitioners and the psychiatrist. As you've read the bill, you'll see that there's even time frames that are built in. After the initial request is made, the doctor cannot move immediately on with that request. There's got to be time that's allowed for the patient to further consider the matter. The whole process can't be rushed through in a very short period of time. Again, this is an extraordinarily serious decision that's being made by the patient. Indeed, it's an extraordinarily serious decision for everyone who's around and caring for that person. And that's why it has to be done at a modest pace with a series of checks and balances to ensure. And as we discussed before, there will be circumstances where a patient, having gone through all of those stages, will then say, well, look, I now have the security of knowing that if this gets too tough for me, I can take this option. But let's just wait and see what happens.
I've recently read that people's fear is that these drugs will fall in the wrong hands. What are the other arguments against this bill?
I hear the arguments of what potentially can go wrong, but where you have gone through the process of going through three doctors, that is the primary medical practitioner, the secondary medical practitioner and a psychiatrist, you've nominated a person to be with you and assist you, I think suggestions that there is some, in a sense, loophole that exposes patients to risk is drawing somewhat of a long bow. We've released this exposure draft. We've set out copies of the bill and explanatory notes to, I think, around about what we've identified as about 100 interested groups or thereabouts in terms of numbers. We will allow essentially a couple of months for people to consider it, you know, whether it be the AMA or the like, and then to come back with any suggestions of change. Now, I suspect that there will be a range of responses. Some of them will be is that the bill is too tough and too restrictive, and you've referred to the 25-year minimum. I anticipate that, as in Victoria, we'll have issues that our defined group who can access it is too narrow and should be expanded to cover other groups. Now, that's an issue of bill design. I don't believe there's a great room for manoeuvre, but groups such as the AMA, palliative care specialists, the Law Society and the Bar Association and other groups may well have suggestions about changes in the wording of the legislation to provide, for instance, more appropriate protections either for patients or for the medical profession that we would certainly try and accommodate if we can. Once we've been through that, we'll then look towards introducing the bill in August or September, and that will involve a period of fairly lengthy discussion and negotiation with parliamentarians across the political spectrum.
Have more people been showing support for this bill?
Oh, well, for a start, we've been through a process now that's been going on for well over 12 months in the development of the bill. We've had a lot of interactions with both Dying with Dignity and previously with Go Gentle, that's the Andrew Denton group, who've been very strong advocates for many years. Since the release of the exposure draft in May, we've been contacted by a large number of people who either are in the end stages of their life or have had a relative who again are saying, please press forward as quickly as possible. Now, it's surprising the level of interest that was shown in the bill and the willingness of people to share their experience with the public.
MP Trevor Kahn hopes to grow more support within the next few weeks in order to help pass this bill through Senate. Next week, I speak with Shane Hickson and her work and support with Die with Dignity.
And a big thank you to Federal MP Trevor Kahn for giving us a clear idea of that proposed bill that's coming up later this year. Tune back in next week to hear the other side of the debate on euthanasia when we speak to Right to Life and other organisations on the euthanasia debate. Next up, we chat to our Chief Space Officer and co-founder of the Two Space movement, Tashi Dorji. You'll listen to Razor's Edge live on 107.3.
Sydney Film Festival is on right now and must finish on Sunday, June 18. Hurry to sff.org.au to choose from hundreds of films on offer at 12 venues across the city, from the beautiful State Theatre to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick. Dramas, documentaries, comedy, horror, music, you name it, you'll be spoilt for choice. Book online or call 1300 733 733. Sydney Film Festival, sponsors of 2SER.
To SCRFM 107.3.
Okay, do stick around.
I think that is actually really sound advice.
And you're back on Razor's Edge with me, Jesse Begley. The sharing economy is slowly shifting the way we work and live. You can share your car with Uber, your home with Airbnb, and your life on social media. So naturally, it was only a matter of time before the sharing world would start to change how we experience work. Today, Hyo Jin spoke with Tashi Dorji, co-founder of Two Space, an organization that turns nighttime restaurants into daytime creative working spaces.
It was one of those instances where the City of Sydney and the Tech Action Plan, and even today, because it was a recent thing, they wanted to make Sydney a more innovative city, like almost a tech hub of Australia. And one of the keys to that, one of the pillars to innovation, they identified was access to workspace, so co-working spaces and also like-minded people.
With some of the spaces that you're offering and the venues, would you say that it's quite a different environment as opposed to traditional workspaces?
What you'll find if you dig a bit deeper is each space is quite unique in terms of, and I'm not just talking about Two Space locations, I'm talking about any co-working hub. They tend to gravitate around a specific industry. So, for example, within the Sydney environment and ecosystem, you have Tankstream Labs, which is a global partner of ours. We're doing a lot of work with them, which is focused around technology and scalable tech. Then you have Stone and Chalk, which is also in Sydney, which is financial tech. Then you have Fishburners, which is early stage startups. Now, with our spaces, because what we're dealing with is, these really creative, inspiring, naturally lit, fresh air, beautiful spot. We really attract a crowd of people from any industry. So that could be anything from like someone who just quit their job as a lawyer and starting their own law business. It gives people the opportunity who normally wouldn't commit to a 5-year lease or a co-working space, surround themselves with like-minded people who are all normally would work from home or from a cafe. Aside from Tankstream, who are amazing, the other partners that we work with and our own venues include, for example, like Amazon Web Services or IBM or legal services, insurance services, because in the spirit of co-working and trying to have everyone give them the equal opportunity to start their own business. And the main reason why we do this for each city we grow into, and even this morning, you know, we were talking about a partnership opportunity in Hong Kong. It's one of those things that's important because we're building our own two-space community in these areas, but it's crucial to partner and work with other pre-existing tech hubs and tech communities in those areas, because it's almost an opportunity to gel those two together and suddenly have this network for people to leverage, not just while they're in that city, but if suddenly you decide to go to Melbourne for a business trip because of the flexibility of two-space, suddenly not only do you have really cool restaurants to work from, but you have access to this tech community that you may never have known that would have existed. That could be, you know, where you find your next developer or your next co-founder or your next client or partner.
As a member of two-space, are we able to go from one venue to another?
It's almost like our early adopters in our community are really excited to have joined us so early, because every time we sign on a new venue, we bring on a new space, they get access to it. So we're almost building a lifestyle for a lot of these freelancers and early stage entrepreneurs. We've got some members who, when they're in the city, they work from the rooftop. Or when they're in Manly, because they actually live in the Northern Beaches, they use the Manly space. And because one of the differentiating factors that we do, so that we're not just like a foot traffic or a platform play, that we put community managers in every space that we set up. So there's a friendly face there who understands the system, that can explain these things to you, that can sit you down and help connect you with the other members. But that also means you can leave your laptop, leave your bag there, because they'll look after it, completely insured. And people love taking advantage of that, because then they could go for a walk. They don't have to worry about minding their desk or their stuff. So literally, we have members leaving their stuff and going diving and seeing sharks and stuff like that for lunchtime, and then coming back and then getting back to work, or going for a surf, drying off, and then coming back and jumping on their laptop and working, because they feel re-energized. Sydney Siders can go to Melbourne, and the guys down in Melbs can come up to Sydney. And when we open the Hong Kong and the Asia spaces, we suddenly bridge the Australian startup ecosystem with, you know, the Southeast Asian ecosystem. So if people travel to and forth from there, or if there's an opportunity to scale into Asia, not only do you have offices waiting for there, but you've got a community there waiting for you, which you can beta test, you can stress test, you can talk to. So even if you have a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday, we find that the future of work, a lot of conglomerates and large companies actually encourage work from home days, or like, you know, they implore their employees to take some time to work from a cafe or something just to get away from their desk. So we get a lot of teams doing offsite bookings or brainstorming sessions from our spaces, because, you know, we're the definition of a creative space. We're looking to activate a lot of spaces. I think we've been around since October 10th. So just over 7 months now. I hope my math is right. And it's one of those things where we've been testing a lot with two locations, but now our goal, just even the next month, is to have over 10, and that's everything in Sydney, Melbourne, and potentially one in Asia very shortly. What I'd love to do is just invite people to jump on the website, because then they can actually see which venues are up and coming. So everything from the ones that are already open and what days are open, with some pictures, to the ones that are coming soon. And also, any listeners in your community, more than happy to welcome them to try out any of our spaces for a free trial. So all they really have to do is walk in one day and the community manager will say, hey, and then they can try it out for a day or two, see what the community is like and the spaces are like.
Oh, and thank you to Tashi Dorji, Chief Space Officer and co-founder of Two-Space, for that story about the modern workplace. Let's go to our next story. Data released last week from the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows a dramatic increase in the Australian prison population. In the last 10 years, 25,968 people per person increase in Australian prisons. Today we have the opportunity to speak with Professor of Criminology at UNSW, Eileen Baldry, about the contributing factors to this problem. Which demographics have seen the biggest spike in Australia's prison population?
Yeah, so over the last 10 years, the three groups that have had the largest increases in imprisonment are the remand population, Indigenous Australians, and women prisoners. And there are some nuances inside those, but those are the three major groups that, to all intents and purposes, are largely driving the very rapid increase.
Is there a factor that each of these demographics share, and what has led to the increase in this incarceration, or is it an increase in, or does each group have their own contributing factors?
Yeah. Look, it's a bit of both. They all have their contributing factors. On the whole, though, the remand population is driven by a number of things. It's partly driven politically, in that there is we hear, you know, every week we hear or we see in newspapers and people commenting and politicians commenting that you know, these people shouldn't be out, and why was somebody on bail, and that despite the fact that the courts should be and in theory are independent of our political and our government, our politicians and government. Nevertheless, there have been increasingly heavy legal changes to increase the likelihood that someone will go to prison on remand rather than being given bail. And this, to some extent, is driven by this fear that if people are being let out on bail and they then are committing offences. Now, there's no question that this happens from time to time, but compared to the number of people who are out on bail, the number who commit offences is extraordinarily small. Another aspect that's driving it is that our court waiting lists are getting longer and longer because we are putting more and more people into prison and holding them on remand, and therefore waiting for their court hearing is taking longer. So that is increasing the number who are staying in remand and filling our prisons. The other aspect of remand is that there are higher rates of people with mental and cognitive disability who go in on remand, and this relates to the first thing that I mentioned, which is that's a group who are likely to be homeless or to have poor housing options, to not have options to be supported in the community, and also a concern that they may not turn up to court because they haven't, they're unwell, or they don't understand fully what to do. Now, that holding people in remand for that reason is really unjustified, and so, you know, those are all things driving the remand population. When we get to women, a high percentage of women who are held in prison are in on remand. So women are a higher proportion than men are a proportion of the remand population. But also women, has been driving the increase in women's prisoner population is almost entirely the increase in Indigenous women being held in prison, either on remand or sentenced.
Yeah. Has the New South Wales government taken any action to try to address the issue of prison populations in New South Wales?
Not really. The action that they've taken is to say that they will build a lot more prisons. So what was reflected at the end of last year was a commitment by the New South Wales government to spend $3.7 billion over the next 10 years on building more prisons so that they could hold more people. So there doesn't appear to have been an appetite to reduce the prisoner population, despite the fact that everybody knows that just putting more and more people in prison does not reduce crime, it does not reduce recidivism, and it actually sets up its own, what one can call a vicious cycle, because the strongest predictor of going to prison is having been in prison before.
And what is the biggest alternative to prison for someone who's committed a criminal offence, in your opinion?
All right, let me go one step back and say prevention of people committing offences is, of course, the first step here. And there are lots of ways in which we could do that a lot better from the point of view of the sorts of things that I just mentioned a minute ago, supporting children, supporting poor children in particular, supporting children who find school a bit of a nightmare, and who the number of kids who end up in juvenile justice and then in adult prison who have been expelled from school or had really, really difficult school experiences is very high. Now, I'm not. This isn't to say that teachers are to blame for that. Quite the opposite. It means that we need to resource our schools and our communities better to support those children and their families. So that would be a first thing. Then a next thing is we resource communities so that there are real pathways for people who are troubled or have difficulty. Now, how do we know that this, this is something that assists people not to do this? It's because, on the whole, it is not young people and young adults from middle class families or wealthier families who end up in the criminal justice system. On the whole, it's people from very poor places. I have all the evidence for this. Some others have. You know, we know that it's by not only by postcode, but by suburb and by street, that we can pinpoint where people who end up in the criminal justice system overwhelmingly come from. And they are poor and disadvantaged places with high unemployment, poor educational outcomes, and not much in the way of pathways into the future. So ensuring that communities have are resourced and have options is one of the biggest and best things we could do to reduce particularly the petty offending that we see, which is what fills our prisons on the whole.
Thank you to Eileen Baldry, Professor of Criminology from the University of New South Wales, for speaking to us. Now, the team here at Razor's Edge are beginning to use a new tool called Seeking Sydney to better engage with you, the local community. If any listeners out there have a question, big or small, about Sydney that you want the Razor's Edge team to investigate, please submit it to us on our website, 2ser.com. What we will do, the team will pick the top three questions, and then you, the public, get to go online and vote on what question you want us to investigate. If you could please head online and engage with that exciting new tool called Seeking Sydney to get the stories you want heard and up on the radio. I'm Jesse Begley, and a big thanks to our Razor's Edge producers getting us these intriguing stories. Ellie Madridge, Monica Samayoa, and Hyo Jin Shim. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge, 2SER's Sydney-focused news and media program. Don't worry, we'll be back at our usual time at 7:30 on Thursdays. Same time, same day, with different stories. If you'd like to hear any of the stories from tonight's program, or indeed any story you've hear us play, you can head over to our website at 2ser.com. Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music, so don't go anywhere. To take us out, we're playing the song from the album of the week, by Big Thief, Capacity, and the song is called Shark Smile. Good night. She was a shark smile.